A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about the history and evolution of combat medicine as a discipline, how it professionalized, and what kind of cross-pollination exists between battlefield trauma care and civilian emergency medicine. He mentions that when we picture combat medics, especially in a country like Israel with mass conscription, we tend to think of junior personnel, but the expertise required suggests a much deeper standing component. So where did this field actually come from, and how much does it bleed back into the civilian world?
The thing that most people don't realize is that combat medicine as a formal, separate discipline is shockingly recent. For most of human history, if you got wounded in battle, your care came from whoever was standing nearby. Maybe a buddy who'd seen an amputation once, maybe a barber surgeon who traveled with the baggage train. There was no systematic approach.
Just vibes and tourniquets.
Vibes and tourniquets is basically the entire pre-modern history of battlefield medicine. The first real shift happened during the Napoleonic Wars. Dominique Jean Leray, Napoleon's chief surgeon, he created something called the Flying Ambulance around 1792. These were horse-drawn carriages designed to retrieve wounded soldiers during active combat and bring them to field hospitals behind the lines. That was revolutionary. Before Leray, wounded men just lay on the field until the battle ended, which could be hours or days.
The innovation wasn't a new surgical technique. It was logistics. Getting the patient to the surgeon before they bled out.
And that principle, rapid evacuation, remains the absolute core of combat medicine today. Leray also introduced triage, by the way. He prioritized treatment based on the severity of wounds regardless of rank. A general with a minor wound waited while a private with a life-threatening injury went first. That was unheard of at the time.
Which probably went over great with the generals.
Napoleon apparently loved it, actually. He called Leray the most virtuous man I have ever known. But the point stands. The two pillars of modern combat medicine, evacuation and triage, both trace back to one French surgeon in the 1790s.
When does it become an actual profession, rather than something a surgeon improvises?
The American Civil War is where you start seeing the precursor to the modern combat medic. The Union Army created an ambulance corps in 1862 under Jonathan Letterman. He's often called the father of battlefield medicine. Letterman built an entire system, dedicated ambulance wagons, stretcher bearers assigned to specific units, field dressing stations, and larger general hospitals further back. He formalized the chain of evacuation.
This is also when you get the first real data on what actually kills soldiers, right?
The Civil War produced massive medical records, the 6-volume medical and surgical history of the War of the Rebellion. About 2/3 of deaths were from disease, not combat wounds, but among the wounded, the big killer was infection. This is pre-germ theory. Surgeons would wipe a blade on a bloody apron and move to the next amputation. The concept of a dedicated person whose job was specifically to stabilize a wounded soldier at the point of injury that hadn't crystallized yet.
The medic as we think of them, the person embedded with a small unit who carries medical gear and treats casualties immediately. When does that role actually appear?
World War I is when it really solidifies. The British Army introduced regimental stretcher bearers and battalion aid posts. The Americans brought in what they called company aid men by World War II. These were soldiers trained in basic first aid who carried bandages, morphine syrettes, sulfa powder. They weren't doctors, they weren't even nurses. They were riflemen with extra medical training, and their job was to stop bleeding and prevent shock long enough for evacuation.
Which brings us to the tension you still see today. How much medical training do you give someone whose primary job might still involve returning fire?
That's the fundamental question of combat medic training, and different militaries have answered it differently. Army's current model is the 68W, the Combat Medic Specialist. That's a 16-week program covering emergency medical treatment, limited primary care, and trauma management. But here's where it gets interesting, and where the prompt's observation about Israel is sharp. The IDF takes a completely different approach.
Let's talk about that, because I think that's where a lot of the cross-pollination with civilian medicine actually shows up most clearly.
In the IDF, the basic combat medic is called a chovesh, literally bandager. They go through a course that's roughly 8 to 10 weeks, depending on the unit. They learn hemorrhage control, airway management, IV access, basic pharmacology. But above them, you have the paramedic level role. The paramedic in IDF terminology is a much more advanced provider. Their training is substantially longer and covers advanced airway management, chest tube insertion, advanced pharmacology, field blood transfusions.
These aren't doctors. They're non-commissioned officers, right?
They're enlisted personnel, or NCOs, not physicians. And this is where the IDF model gets interesting from a professionalization standpoint. In the U military, a lot of advanced battlefield care is pushed up to physician assistants and battalion surgeons, actual doctors. The IDF has pushed advanced interventions down to the paramedic level because of how their units operate. Small teams, dispersed operations, limited evacuation windows.
The Israeli model professionalizes downward. It takes procedures that in other militaries are restricted to physicians and gives them to trained NCOs, which means the standing component the prompt mentions is real. You can't train someone to do a chest tube in 8 weeks.
No, you absolutely cannot. The IDF paramedic course is reportedly about 6 months, followed by extensive field training. These are career personnel or long-term conscripts who've extended their service. And this creates exactly the standing professional cadre that the prompt was asking about. You have people who spend years doing nothing but combat trauma care, rotating between operational units, training exercises, and, critically, civilian ambulance services.
That's the cross-pollination right there.
That's the cross-pollination. Many IDF paramedics and senior medics do shifts with Magen David Adom, Israel's National Emergency Medical Service. The civilian side gets people who are extremely comfortable with penetrating trauma, mass casualty incidents, improvised tourniquets. The military side gets people who see a wider variety of medical presentations and maintain their skills between deployments. It's a deliberate pipeline.
Let's zoom out historically for a second. The prompt asks, when combat medicine evolved as a separate discipline, you've traced it from Larry to Letterman to the company aid man to the modern combat medic. But when does it become a recognized medical specialty? Something with journals, conferences, a body of research?
The Vietnam War is the inflection point. Vietnam produced a massive amount of trauma data because evacuation times dropped dramatically with helicopter ME-DVAC. You had wounded soldiers reaching surgical hospitals within an hour of injury, sometimes within 20 minutes. This created a natural experiment, what kills people when you get them to a surgeon fast.
The answer was hemorrhage.
The leading cause of preventable combat death is hemorrhage from extremity wounds. This was documented extensively during Vietnam and led directly to the development of modern trauma systems. But the formal recognition of combat medicine as a distinct subspecialty really crystallized after the 1993 Battle of Mogadishu, Black Hawk Down. The military realized that the old model of stabilize and evacuate didn't work when you couldn't evacuate.
Because you're pinned down in a city.
If the helicopter can't land, your golden hour becomes a very long afternoon. This led to the development of tactical combat casualty care. TCCC, which is now the foundational doctrine for battlefield medicine across NATO and beyond. TCCC was formalized in 1996 by the U Special Operations Command. It breaks care into three phases: care under fire, tactical field care, and tactical evacuation care.
Care under fire being, suppress the enemy, get the casualty to cover, apply a tourniquet if you can, but the priority is returning fire.
The medic's first job in care under fire is not medicine, it's fire superiority. You can't treat a casualty if you're both dead. This was a major doctrinal shift. Previously, the medic was seen as a protected non-combatant under the Geneva Conventions. TCCC said the medic is a combatant who provides care when tactically feasible.
Which is a much more honest description of how small unit combat actually works.
It saved enormous numbers of lives. The data from Iraq and Afghanistan showed that implementing TCCC across conventional forces, not just special operations, reduced preventable combat deaths by something like 25 to 30%. The specific figure cited in some military medicine journals is that TCCC implementation led to the lowest case fatality rate in the history of warfare. around 8 to 10%, compared to roughly 19% in Vietnam and 25% in World War II.
We went from 1 in 4 wounded dying to fewer than 1 in 10. That's a staggering improvement, and it all happened within a couple generations.
A lot of it came down to three interventions that sound almost too simple: tourniquets, hemostatic dressings, and rapid blood product administration. Tourniquets were actually discouraged for decades because of the belief that they caused unnecessary limb loss. The data from Iraq and Afghanistan completely reversed that. Early tourniquet application saves lives, and the limb can survive several hours of tourniquet time if you get the casualty to a surgeon.
The thing that strikes me about that is how counterintuitive it must have seemed at the time. Don't use a tourniquet, you'll cost them the leg. Versus use a tourniquet, they'll keep the leg because they'll still be alive.
That's exactly the paradigm shift, and it's a perfect example of combat medicine feeding back into civilian practice. For decades, civilian EMS was also tourniquet-averse for the same reason. The military data from the early 2000s was so compelling that it changed civilian protocols worldwide. Now you see tourniquets in every ambulance, in police cruisers, in public access bleeding control kits. The Stop the Bleed campaign, that's a direct descendant of TCCC doctrine.
Let's talk more about that feedback loop, because I think it's the most interesting part of the prompt. How much does battlefield medicine actually shape what happens in a civilian ER?
It's enormous, and it goes both ways. Let me give you a few concrete examples. Whole blood resuscitation. Giving trauma patients whole blood rather than component therapy, packed red cells and plasma separately, was pioneered by the military in Iraq and Afghanistan. They found that whole blood worked better, was simpler to administer, and could be carried by medics in the field. Now civilian trauma centers are adopting walking blood bank programs and pre-hospital whole blood administration.
Walking blood bank being, you test everyone in the unit, you know their blood type, and if someone needs blood, you have a pre-screened donor right there.
The Ranger Regiment pioneered this. They pre-screen every member, and in a mass casualty situation, they can draw blood from one Ranger and infuse it into another on the spot. This has been adopted by some civilian EMS systems in the U, particularly in rural areas where blood products aren't readily available.
What about damage control surgery? I know that came out of military experience.
Damage control surgery is probably the single most important military to civilian translation in trauma care. The concept is, when a patient is in physiological extremis, they're cold, acidotic, and coagulopathic, you don't do a definitive repair. You do the minimum necessary to stop bleeding and control contamination, pack the abdomen, and get them to the ICU to warm up and stabilize. You come back 24 to 48 hours later for the definitive operation.
The trauma triad of death: hypothermia, acidosis, coagulopathy.
That concept was developed by military surgeons and then validated extensively in civilian trauma centers. Now it's standard of care worldwide. The military also drove the development of hemostatic resuscitation, the idea that you should replace blood with blood, not with crystalloid fluids. For decades, civilian trauma care was dominated by the idea of pumping patients full of saline or Ringer's lactate. The military showed that this actually worsens outcomes. It dilutes clotting factors and makes bleeding worse.
The old two large bore IVs wide open, that was killing people?
In major trauma, yes. The current approach is permissive hypotension. You let the blood pressure stay low enough to avoid popping clots, and you replace volume with blood products, not saline. This came directly out of military experience and has been adopted by civilian trauma centers over the last 15 years.
What about the civilian to military direction? What does the military learn from civilian emergency medicine?
Ultrasound. The widespread use of point-of-care ultrasound in trauma, the FAST exam, that was developed primarily in civilian emergency departments and then adopted by military forward surgical teams. Advanced airway management techniques. Video laryngoscopy, surgical airways. A lot of the refinement happened in civilian academic centers. And there's a less tangible thing. Civilian EM physicians who deploy as reservists bring back a huge amount of experience with blunt trauma, pediatric trauma, medical resuscitation that you don't see as much in a purely combat setting.
I'm also thinking about the institutional knowledge problem. You build up this incredible trauma expertise during a war, and then the war ends and you demobilize. How do you preserve that?
That's been a major concern, especially after the drawdown in Iraq and Afghanistan. Military established the Joint Trauma System in 2004, specifically to capture and analyze combat trauma data in real time and translate it into clinical practice guidelines. They maintain a trauma registry with detailed data on every significant combat injury. That's how they were able to identify that tourniquets work, that whole blood works, that certain interventions were causing harm.
It's not just, we have good medics. It's, we have a learning system that gets better every year.
And the Joint Trauma System has been described as one of the most significant advances in military medicine since Letterman. It creates a continuous feedback loop. Injury occurs, data is captured, analysis identifies patterns, guidelines are updated, training is modified, outcomes improve. That's the professionalization the prompt was asking about. Combat medicine went from being a set of techniques passed down by senior medics to a data-driven clinical discipline.
Let's talk about the Israeli side more specifically, because I think there's an interesting comparison. The IDF doesn't have the luxury of treating combat medicine as something you only need during active wars. The operational tempo is continuous.
That's a key distinction. The IDF Medical Corps maintains a very high readiness level at all times because the transition from peacetime to wartime can happen with essentially no warning. Their medics and paramedics are continuously training, and they rotate through civilian trauma exposure deliberately. There was a piece in the Jerusalem Post recently about how the IDF is integrating lessons from the current operational environment into their medical training pipeline, specifically around prolonged field care.
Prolonged field care being, you can't evacuate, so you have to keep someone alive for hours or even days with limited resources.
This is the scenario that TCCC was originally designed for, but it's become even more relevant in certain operational contexts. If you're operating in a denied area or the airspace is contested, your golden hour might become a golden day. The IDF Medical Corps has been developing protocols for exactly that scenario. How do you manage a casualty when evacuation is delayed by 12, 24, 48 hours?
That's basically turning a medic into a field hospital.
And it requires a completely different skill set than the traditional stop the bleeding and call for a helicopter model. You need to manage fluids and electrolytes over time, prevent infection, manage pain without over-sedating, deal with compartment syndrome, handle wounds that are going to sit for a day before they see a surgeon. It's essentially austere critical care.
Which is also relevant for civilian disaster medicine, right? Earthquake, hurricane, mass casualty? You might have the same prolonged evacuation problem.
And that's another feedback loop. The military's prolonged field care protocols are being adapted for civilian disaster response. FEMA and other agencies have been looking at this closely. The military has also learned from civilian experience with things like telemedicine, using remote physician consultation to guide medics through procedures they wouldn't normally perform.
I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier about the professionalization timeline. You said TCCC was formalized in 1996. That's 30 years ago. Before that, what was the standard?
It was much more fragmented. Individual units had their own protocols. Special operations units trained their medics extensively, but there was no unified doctrine. The 18D, the Army Special Forces medic, was legendary for having an incredibly deep medical training pipeline, something like a year of training covering everything from trauma to veterinary medicine to dentistry. But that was a niche capability, not a system-wide standard.
The conventional medic was basically an EMT with a rifle.
The training was heavily focused on primary care, sick call stuff, colds and sprains, because that's what medics spent most of their time doing in garrison. Trauma training was secondary. TCCC flipped that. It said, your primary job is combat trauma. Everything else is secondary.
Which makes intuitive sense, but apparently took 200 years of military medicine to figure out.
Institutional inertia is powerful. And there was genuine debate about this. Some people argued that medics needed to be generalists because they were the only healthcare provider for their unit in the field. The counterargument, which won out, was that the medic's unique value is trauma care under fire. Anyone can hand out ibuprofen. Only the medic is trained to place a chest tube while taking fire.
What does the career path look like now for someone who wants to do this? You mentioned the standing professional component. What does that actually look like in terms of ranks, training pipelines, career progression?
It varies by military, but let me sketch the U and Israeli models because they're illustrative. In the U Army, the 68W combat medic can progress through several levels. There's the basic medic, then you can get additional skill identifiers for things like flight medic, special operations combat medic, critical care flight paramedic. The pinnacle is the 18D Special Forces Medical Sergeant, or the 1/60th SOAR Flight Paramedic. These are people with training comparable to physician assistants.
These are career paths, not just something you do for one enlistment.
Someone might spend 20 years in military medicine, moving from line medic to instructor to special operations to physician assistant school. The military has recognized that this expertise is too valuable to lose after 4 years. There are retention bonuses, advanced civilian certifications, pathways to commissioning. The IDF model is different because of conscription. Most medics are conscripts who serve roughly 3 years, but above them, the paramedics and senior medical NCOs are often career personnel. The IDF also has a reserve component that's crucial. Reserve medics and paramedics who have civilian healthcare jobs and bring that expertise when they're called up. A reserve battalion might have medics who are emergency physicians, ICU nurses, paramedics in their civilian lives.
That's an interesting model. You don't try to maintain all the expertise in the standing force. You distribute it across the reserve force and mobilize it when needed.
It works because Israel's reserve system is unusually active. Reservists train regularly. They deploy. They maintain their military skills. A reserve medic isn't someone who did a medic course 10 years ago and hasn't touched a bandage since. They're actively practicing.
Let's talk about technology for a bit. What's actually changed in terms of what a medic carries and what they can do?
The medic's kit has transformed dramatically. In World War II, a medic carried bandages, morphine serrettes, sulfa powder, and not much else. Today's combat medic carries hemostatic gauze impregnated with kaolin or chitosan. These are agents that actively promote clotting. They carry junctional tourniquets for wounds in the groin or armpit where a standard tourniquet won't work. They carry chest seals for sucking chest wounds. Needle decompression kits for tension pneumothorax. Intraosseous drills for getting vascular access through bone when veins have collapsed.
Intraosseous access. Drilling into the bone marrow. That's wild to think about doing in the field.
It's actually faster and easier than IV access in a crashing patient, and the bone marrow functions as a non-collapsible vein. You can push fluids, blood products, medications, everything goes through the IO line. This was a military innovation that's now standard in civilian EMS.
Blood products. You mentioned whole blood earlier. What about freeze-dried plasma?
Freeze-dried plasma is a major advance. It's plasma that's been lyophilized into a powder, so it's stable at room temperature and can be reconstituted with sterile water in minutes. No refrigeration required. The French military pioneered this, and it's been adopted by several NATO countries, is using it increasingly. It lets a medic carry a blood product that can treat coagulopathy, the clotting failure that kills trauma patients, without needing a refrigerated supply chain.
What about pharmacological advances?
Tranexamic acid is a great example of civilian to military transfer. TXA is an antifibrinolytic. It prevents clots from breaking down. It was developed for heavy menstrual bleeding and surgical use, but a large civilian trauma trial called CRASH-2 in 2010 showed it reduced mortality in bleeding trauma patients if given within 3 hours. The military adopted it immediately. Now TXA is in every medic's kit, and it's given as early as possible, ideally within minutes of injury.
A drug for heavy periods ends up saving soldiers' lives. That's a cross-pollination nobody would have predicted.
Medicine is full of those. Another one is ketamine. Ketamine is an old anesthetic, developed in the 1960s. It fell out of favor in civilian practice for a long time because of its dissociative effects, the K-hole and all that. But the military embraced it because it's the perfect battlefield anesthetic. It maintains blood pressure, it preserves airway reflexes, it provides excellent pain control, and you can't overdose it easily. Now, ketamine is having a renaissance in civilian emergency medicine and pre-hospital care.
Because the military demonstrated its utility in the most austere conditions imaginable.
When you've used ketamine successfully on a casualty in the back of a helicopter under night vision goggles, using it in an ambulance bay seems straightforward.
What about the psychological side? Combat medicine isn't just about stopping bleeding. There's the whole dimension of treating someone who's been traumatized while you yourself are in the same firefight. How has the understanding of that evolved?
This is an area where there's been real growth. The old model was basically suck it up and do your job. The new model recognizes that medics are at extremely high risk for post-traumatic stress and moral injury. They're not just witnessing trauma, they're responsible for treating it, often in people they know personally. Your patient is your friend. If they die, you carry that.
The decisions you have to make. Who to treat first, who to leave behind because they're beyond help. Those are morally heavy in a way that's hard to prepare for.
Triage in combat is brutal. In a civilian mass casualty, you triage based on clinical criteria. In combat, you also have to factor in tactical considerations. If treating one casualty means exposing three others to fire, you might have to make a decision that haunts you. The military has gotten much better about acknowledging this and providing support. Pre-deployment resilience training, post-deployment mental health screening, peer support programs. But it's still an enormous challenge.
I'm thinking about the prompt's observation that we tend to picture these as junior personnel. There's something about that. The image of the young medic, barely out of training, making life or death decisions under fire, that captures both the heroism and the weight of the role.
It's true that many combat medics are young, but the system behind them is anything but junior. The clinical practice guidelines they follow are written by some of the best trauma surgeons and emergency physicians in the world. The equipment they carry is the product of decades of research and development. The training they receive is continuously updated based on real casualty data. That's the professionalization. The individual medic might be a 20-year-old conscript, but they're operating within a system that represents the accumulated expertise of 2 centuries of military medicine.
That's a good way to frame it. The medic is the tip of a very deep spear.
And that's true whether you're talking about an IDF Quvesh, or a U Army 68W, or a British Combat Medical Technician. The individual provider is embedded in an institutional framework that extends all the way back to Larry's flying ambulances.
Let me ask you something about the future. Where is combat medicine heading? What's the next frontier?
A few things. One is autonomous evacuation. Unmanned aerial vehicles that can extract casualties without risking a pilot and crew. Military has been experimenting with this. Another is advanced monitoring. Wearable sensors that can detect hemorrhage early by tracking physiological changes before the casualty even knows they're badly hurt. There's work on automated tourniquets, on injectable hemostatic agents that can stop internal bleeding, on synthetic blood substitutes that don't require refrigeration or blood typing.
Synthetic blood has been the holy grail for decades.
It has, and it's still not quite there. But there are hemoglobin-based oxygen carriers in advanced trials that could be fielded within the next decade. If you can carry a shelf-stable, universally compatible oxygen carrier that doesn't need cross-matching, you fundamentally change the logistics of combat resuscitation.
All of this flows back into civilian care eventually. The synthetic blood, the autonomous evacuation, the early hemorrhage detection.
That's the pattern. Military necessity drives innovation, and the innovation eventually diffuses into the civilian world. Sometimes it takes years or decades. Sometimes it happens faster. The tourniquet revolution happened in less than 10 years. But the cross-pollination is continuous and bidirectional.
To answer the prompt directly, combat medicine evolved as a formal discipline starting with Larry in the 1790s, professionalized through Letterman in the American Civil War, became a recognized specialty after Vietnam, and developed its current doctrinal framework with TCCC in 1996. The standing professional component is substantial, especially in the IDF where paramedics are career personnel, and the cross-pollination with civilian emergency medicine is deep and bidirectional. Tourniquets, whole blood, damage control surgery, TXA, ketamine, IO access, and the entire trauma system approach all flow back and forth between the battlefield and the ER.
That's a good summary. I'd add that one of the most important cross-pollination vectors is people. The reservists, the veterans, the military-trained medics who become civilian paramedics and nurses and physicians. The institutional knowledge doesn't just live in guidelines and journal articles. It lives in the practitioners who've done this work under fire and bring that experience to their civilian practice.
The other direction, too. The civilian trauma surgeon who deploys as a reservist and brings back techniques and perspectives from their academic medical center.
It's a human network as much as it's an institutional one.
One thing I want to circle back to. You mentioned the joint trauma system and the data-driven approach. Is there an equivalent in the civilian world that captures trauma data at that scale?
The American College of Surgeons runs the National Trauma Data Bank, which is the largest aggregation of trauma registry data in the United States. It's been enormously influential in developing quality improvement programs and benchmarking trauma center performance. But it's not quite the same as the military system, because the military system captures data from the point of injury through the entire chain of evacuation and definitive care. In the civilian world, the pre-hospital and hospital data systems are often fragmented.
The military actually has better data integration than most civilian systems.
In some respects, yes, because the military owns the entire chain, from the medic on the ground to the field hospital to the medical evacuation aircraft to the definitive care facility in Germany or the United States. There's a single medical record that follows the patient. In the civilian world, you might have an ambulance service that uses one electronic health record, a community hospital that uses another, and a trauma center that uses a third, and none of them talk to each other.
That's a pretty good argument for the military model influencing civilian trauma systems going forward.
It already is. The civilian world is looking at the military's integrated trauma registry as a model for regional trauma systems. There are pilot programs in several states trying to create exactly that kind of seamless data flow.
All right, I think we've covered the history, the professionalization, the cross-pollination, and the future direction. Anything we missed?
I think we hit the major points. The only thing I'd add is that combat medicine is ultimately a discipline defined by constraints. You're operating with limited equipment, limited time, limited evacuation options, under direct threat. And that constraint-driven innovation is what makes it so generative for the broader medical world. When you solve a problem under the worst possible conditions, the solution tends to work pretty well under normal conditions too.
Like developing a recipe in a kitchen, where the power keeps going out and someone's shooting at the stove.
Actually, a perfect analogy.
I've been saving that one.
Of course you have.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1960s, scientists discovered a subglacial lake beneath the Antarctic ice sheet and named it Lake Vostok. Vostok meaning east in Russian, after the research station above it. The lake had been sealed off from the surface for at least 15 million years.
15 million years under the ice. Just sitting there.
Waiting for us to name it, East Lake. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review. It genuinely helps other people find the show. Find us at myweirdprompts.com. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.